What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast, episode 121, Sideline CT Scanners with MedLogic. And we have Dr. Ott sitting right next to Janine McGowan, and we have Brad Brown, the Director of Sports Medicine for the Ironman Sports Medicine Institute. So Janine McGowan and Pete Thompson came all the way from Pennsylvania just to be on the Sports Medicine Broadcast and tell us about the InfraScanner. And we have a couple questions for you, and then hopefully Dr. Ott will have plenty to say, and Brad can chime in with his experience in the NFL. We were having a real good conversation over here before we got started, so hopefully we can fake it and act like those are the first time we're asking those questions. So I am your host, Jeremy Jackson, and sitting right beside me today is...
Jasmine.
Shakira.
And Marlon's over there. We got a little bit... Schedule's a little different, so things are a little different. And then we have over here...
Jess.
And Olivia.
And Olivia. That's a sports medicine class. They're the ones responsible for all the production, and I don't think they get enough credit. I just probably don't tell them enough. Thank you. If you want to check it out, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com, using hashtag DSMB on Twitter. Jasmine's on Twitter. Matthew's on Twitter. Leslie should be typing in show notes. So if you have questions for or about anything we're saying on Twitter, or Shakira has the live stream if you're logged in. I see somebody's logged in there. Who's that?
Doc.
All right, so Doc is watching it from the other room. So if you have questions, you can type it in the chat room. So again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. That has links to all the stuff. And without much further ado, Pete, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself, and then we'll just go around.
Pete Thompson with MedLogic.
Tell us like credentials, a little background, that kind of thing.
I've been a lawyer for 21 years and had the opportunity to get involved in a business that is distributing the InfraScanner. And a client of mine approached me to help him get involved with it, and I fell in love with it and decided that it was much more interesting than practicing law. So we've formed a company. We've been in business for 2 years, and it's really been exciting. Dealing with new technology has its challenges, and we've been trying to address each one as they come up.
All right, very cool.
My name's Janine McGowan. I work with MedLogic. My background is in marketing and design. Pete sort of pulled me in to help. There's a lot of education and awareness that comes with disruptive technology. So we've just been trying to get the word out and educate people that there's this brand new technology available.
Disruptive technology. What is that? Just new?
New technology. Okay. Yeah, nothing out there
normal.
Like it. Right.
Okay, I got you. I was about to say, I'm pretty sure this reads when there's the damage, not causes damage. So, all right. And then Dr. Summerott has been on the podcast twice before, and I have that in the show notes. Episode 92 was when we were at the Memorial Hermann Conference this summer, and then episode 25 was about two years ago when we were kind of just getting started. And so, Dr. Ott, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about
yourself?
Thanks
for having me. I am the director of the Ironman Sports Medicine Concussion Program, and I'm also a neuropsychologist. And I work pretty closely with area high schools, and also served as team physician for the Houston Texans, doing concussion management for them for 6 seasons, as well as working with other universities throughout Texas. I did a fellowship in Pittsburgh, actually, at UPMC, where a lot of the concussion management originated. And they'll be talking about Joe Maroon today, who's also from Pittsburgh. And so he worked very closely with colleagues of mine to develop the IMPACT tool, which we might also discuss at some point.
And... Brad.
My name is Brad Brown. I'm an athletic trainer. My background is primarily from the NFL. I spent 29 years in the NFL. So I have a decent background on how concussions have kind of transpired over the years and how we've treated those. So I'm very interested in listening to this and kind of seeing what this new technology is. And then I'll give my perspective as to how an athletic trainer may look at this. So
it's good. Maybe they'll be able to pick your brain on some talking points, because they're going to see Jeff at the Houston Texans after this. And so maybe you can give them some good selling points.
Okay.
All right. Olivia's going to start us off with the first question.
Please tell us about the InfraScanner.
The InfraScanner is a non-invasive portable medical device that uses near-infrared technology, and it helps medical professionals with an expedited, more accurate assessment of whether or not there is a brain bleed. It was designed in partnership with the U.S. military, the Navy, and the Marine Corps. It's been used on the battlefield since 2008, and it was FDA approved in January of 2013. And the InfraScanner, simply put, in sports medicine is an extra tool in an athletic trainer's toolbox, where it's not replacing their clinical judgment in any way, but it's simply helping make their judgment call better on the sidelines because the InfraScanner offers clinical data. It's not subjective, but it's clinical, objective data.
All right, so, never mind, I forgot. Go ahead.
And where do you see this most likely being used?
Well, the InfraScanner in sports medicine, we believe, is a very valuable use. And that is because often sport-related concussions are in treatment getting CT scans. The Pittsburgh Steelers used the InfraScanner this season on any player that was suspected of a concussion. And one of the goals of its use is to reduce unnecessary CT scans because a CT scan carries with it a large dose of radiation, which is equivalent to be between 300 and 400 chest x-rays to the head. And so the Steelers team neurosurgeon in particular felt that it was something that that would be useful to be able to mitigate those. Dr. Maroon used the InfraScanner on several players that he otherwise would have sent to get a CT scan, but being able to, because the InfraScan test was negative, gave a level of comfort to the player, the other team physicians, and the family that there was no emergency situation and that the player could remain, you know, with the team. And he also felt that it's particularly useful for away games, so that there is less disruption having to send a player to an emergency room, and the inconvenience and other things that are associated with that.
All right. So with it being most likely being used, I know you said you guys want to see it in sports medicine. It's right now. It's currently used in the military. That's where it was designed for, and then. You had mentioned to me in one of the emails that there's people in Houston that are using it.
Yes, at Bentaw General Hospital and
Seton Brain Institute, which is in Austin, Texas. Dr. Alex Vladka, and in Bentaw General Hospital, it's Dr. Claudia Robertson.
And we also have, there's EMS and fire departments throughout Ohio, Alabama, and Pennsylvania using the InfraScanner. We've got several devices, a dozen placed in West Virginia at critical access hospitals. It's great with rural medicine. And it's also at a lot of Trauma One hospitals, including the two in Texas, in Pennsylvania, Kansas.
Philadelphia. Miami, Florida. Its use in hospitals is it varies. There are some hospitals where they're using it is in the emergency department to simply screen for a CT scan, and others they're using it to for neurological assessments and monitoring after somebody has already been admitted and they've identified a brain bleed and they may have even had surgery. They can, because of the potential reoccurrence for a brain bleed after surgery. And simply to monitor those patients. Also, in fall management in hospitals, if a patient falls in a hospital, often they're sent to get a CT scan, and then if the scan is negative, they'll go back to their room and develop a delayed bleed, particularly with elderly patients, that bleed may not show up for several hours. And there have been instances of patients dying. And so what the hospitals and fall management are using it for is after the patient is given a CT scan, they return back to the room, the nursing staff then will monitor that patient over the course of the next 6 or 7 hours, doing repeat measurements with the InfraScan, again, which is non-invasive.
All right, so obviously we're looking for sports medicine here, and this is
That's correct.
For military grade. What happens if I have this in my bag at a game and it starts raining? Is this something that I have to have in a waterproof case? Do I need to keep it in that box? Talk about the durability.
It's very durable. It's windproof, waterproof. You can throw it down because of the military specs for it. It's very durable. You would want to, when you an athlete is suspected of having a concussion, you probably take them aside, maybe in the locker room or something, and that's where you would do the InfraScanner.
If I may, in the NFL, which is the classic model, the protocols, I believe, would be once a player is suspected of a concussion, under the John Madden rule, they're taken, you know, into a quiet place, a locker room, and they're given a neurological evaluation. It's at that point that the infrascan test would be used. It's not something that would be used out on the, you know, field of play, actually at the sideline. It would be something that, you know, in the NFL, the player would be taken into the locker room and given a neurological evaluation. At that point, you would, you know, because it only takes 2 minutes, you would conduct the test at that point.
All right, so how quickly after the initial injury would they be able to, would the bleeding be able to, bleeding occur that the infrascanner could detect it? Because a lot of times they'll get the, you know, get the concussion, get the call from upstairs, and then they'll take them in right away. So is it within 10 minutes, within 2 minutes of?
It's more the volume of blood. The infrascanner can pick up a bleed starting at 3.5 cc's in volume. As a comparison, our Dr. Maroon and some of the other doctors have told us that a CT scan doesn't start picking up a bleed till it's 5.5 cc's in volume, and it's not clinically relevant to operate until it's upwards of 50 cc's in volume. So it's more the volume of the bleed, and again, the beauty of the infrascanner is that you can keep repeating it, you know, as your judgment goes and as you're observing the athlete or your patient. If you need to do it every 10 minutes, you can. You'd have no ionizing radiation.
All right, so again, if you guys have questions at any point, comments, jump in.
Yeah, one of the things that I think about, we have a lot of tools and, you know, many things are coming on the market for concussion management. This is the most highly studied area and everybody wants to get on board. I mean, a number of people see this as a financial gain as well to develop certain tools, of course. I'm glad to see it's FDA approved. I mean, many things we get exposed to as professionals aren't reputable or studied or backed by individuals who have a lot of clinical and neurosurgical expertise. But what is the credential, or what are the credentials? Are they published as to who can utilize or perform this infra scanner? And secondly, how is the purchase of it regulated? Because we have a lot of people purchasing tools that aren't qualified and misusing them. So I'd hate to see a parent who has no medical background get a hold of something like this at home and start doing it on their child that bumped their head.
That's a very good question. The FDA indications are under the direction for use under the direction of a physician. So we are not going to sell it to a family. Mm-hmm. We won't sell it to any. I mean, it's our responsibility to sell the device, and we are only selling it to, you know, hospitals, sports medicine, you know, practices mm-hmm. such as yours, high schools, you know, NFL teams, colleges, you know, only to be used by athletic trainers, nurses in a school mm-hmm. district. As an example, in Pittsburgh, West Allegheny School District was the first school district in the country to buy the device. They got it through a grant. They got funding through a grant from Highmark. Mm-hmm. And so they wrote a protocol that uses the device by the school nurse, the athletic trainers, and the school mm-hmm. physician. And that's it. The coaches don't use it. The parents don't use it. Nobody would use it except for those people who were trained and who you know are under the direction of a physician, because the school physician would deem the athletic trainers to be able to use it, just like.
Well, and many times on the sidelines, we're not always fortunate to have a physician on the sidelines, and we have athletic trainers there. So many times it kind of sounds like the liability could be on the athletic trainer, though, to, at their discretion, utilize the instrument. A physician may not be present. So it's not like in an emergency room setting where orders being given directly by a physician. So it sounds like there could be, maybe could speak to some potential liability possibly for doing this if something goes wrong and something isn't picked up.
Yeah, I don't want to mislead you. I think that the athletic trainers would be using it on a regular basis. When I say used under the direction of a physician, I'm not saying that the physician is watching them
okay.
do it. Simply that the physician has okayed it.
So, like the physician, they support the use of it in that protocol.
The physician for the school district or for the team has accepted it and said, we'll use it. Mm-hmm. Who's going to be using it? The nursing staff and the athletic trainer. So the athletic trainer would use it completely in discretion that they would use with their own guidelines that, of course, are come up with the physicians and their organizations. So nobody who's using this device has to change their existing concussion protocols. That's a very important element of this. Nope, we're not asking anybody to do something different. All they're doing is adding an additional test to their already existing neurological evaluation. So in terms of liability, they have liability anyways.
That's
so
true.
If they don't catch a brain bleed because of their neurological evaluations, then they've got liability. So if they are using an FDA-approved, you know, medical device that's been tested by the Marine Corps and financed by the Marine Corps, that's something that, as a lawyer, I'm standing there, I'm proud that somebody used it. And if they still missed it, even though they used it, they were going to miss it anyway.
Yeah. But you would agree, as a lawyer, some people will bring up the fact that, how were they trained? You know, did they meet competencies and so forth, like we do for a lot of other instruments?
And Janine can speak to that in terms of our training program. I think it's a very good question.
We have an 18-minute training video. Part of it was done with the military supplier, which is ADS. We had an actual medic from the Marines that used it, and he's in the video. But it's an 18-minute training, and then we do hands-on, because it's as simple to use as it looks, but there are a lot of techniques to using it in order to assure successful handling of it.
And anybody who's trained receives a certificate that they've been trained. And then we have reissuing certificates because, as an example, one of the Pittsburgh Steeler team neurosurgeons was trained in, I think, August of 2012. Well, he's not a regular user of the device. He goes to games when Dr. Maroon doesn't go to the games. And, you know, here we are, you know, on a snowy night somewhere, and he's using it, and he hasn't used it for several years, or maybe a half a dozen times. So we need to be able to reach back out to these folks who we've trained and recertify them for training, because it's really important for proper use that they're trained and that the training has been, you know, done appropriately.
And we sort of have 24-hour support. If anybody using the device ever needs anything, if they need retrained, if any of their staff need retrained, we do that. There's particularly a sports medicine clinic in Gallipolis, Ohio, and the person using it kind of trained herself in an improper technique. So we met with her again and, you know, cleared up everything. You want to make sure that you...
A lot of checks and balances.
Yeah, you hold it steady and that you just cover about, you know, a few points and you can be really successful with it. And it takes practice like anything else.
Sure.
Jeremy and Dr. Ott, one of the things that we've really made a very, very conscious effort to do is to make this, roll it out in an appropriate and right way, because it's such a sensitive subject. And as you said, so many people are trying to get into the concussion area in medical, you know, devices and these other things. And we really were focused more on, you know, military and hospital use, but it just was such a natural application for the device that using it in sports medicine, it's just we want to be very careful about how, you know, who's using it and how it's rolled out.
Right.
So
I have a question, I guess, and I think this is important to kind of throw out here, and I guess it's the I'm trying to guess the right way to say this, the true need for it at this level. Dr. Ott may be able to address this a little better than I do. But, I mean, with my background as an athletic trainer, and I've been in the business over 35 years, I can honestly say that I don't think I ever had a brain bleed. Knock on wood, we were fortunate. But I guess as we sit here today, and my new role is more dealing with high school and younger kids, and Dr. Ott may be able to answer this, is the prevalence of a brain bleed higher or lower? And is it something that, you know, everybody should be alarmed about? Because, you know, and if you really look at it in a sports setting, the likelihood of that is really not very high. And as we, you know, even with the CT scans, and we say, you know, we're eliminating CT scans, we didn't CT scan every concussion that we had. Now, maybe some places do as a precaution, but, you know, ours was a deal where, you know, you had to kind of look at the symptoms and everything else that was going on before you would do the CT scan as well. So I can see this as a tool, but I guess, my thinking is that we don't want to lose track of its usefulness in our industry? Is it more of just a bell and whistle type of thing and something that, you know, isn't just another tool, or is it something that Dr. Ott and her staff and the doctors that see these kids is probably more useful than putting that responsibility on the athletic trainers?
Well, and I think I might agree with the utility being hired a trauma setting, where, I mean, we do have helmets, and we talk about helmets all the time and their utility in sports, and they don't prevent concussions. You know, the use of them, of course, is to prevent hopefully catastrophic issues like this. So we don't see that as often. But I do have to say, I had a baseball player. I want to be clear, I wasn't on the sideline, but he was a pitcher, and he was hit by a batted ball, and it hit him in the frontal region of the head. The impact was so significant, the ball bounced back into the outfield, and immediately the athletic trainer removed him. He was knocked out for a couple of seconds, evaluated him, and he looked seemingly fine and neurologically intact when he was evaluated. And then, as you know, the athletic trainer continued to monitor him like you're taught to do. He did have some deterioration at that point, given he was in a rural setting, you know, not close to a medical facility. It may have gave some insight into, you know, what kind of transport do we have for the person. So that might be an example, but I think on the whole, we don't necessarily have all of those experiences that we might have with car accidents when people are in EMS and transporting people. I think that would be good knowledge as a person's entering the emergency room. For me, clinically, when I see people outpatient, which could be anywhere from the day after to even a few days later, we've had some stat CTs that we've wanted to get really quickly, and I think that may have been useful to get that, or to appease the parent that is so just distraught about that no one has ordered a CT scan for their son or daughter, even though we know neurologically things appear good and we've went through all of our checks and balances. You know, just to be able to say to the mom or dad that we have something that's not going to affect them, maybe with radiation, because that is a significant concern and why most physicians don't want to do it, especially in our little tykes, the parent may walk away with at least a bit more, you know, alleviation of their concern. So I think there's definitely utility, but I don't know that it's as high on the sideline as it might be in some of our other settings.
Those are really good points, and I know Janine has a couple things she wants to address too. Why don't you go ahead first?
Well, as far as the high school kids in the 2013 season, 8 kids died of a brain bleed. That's a lot, especially if it's your kid playing the game they love at 16 years old and that's it. 25 that year suffered a catastrophic injury, and actually 3 kids from Texas were life-flighted from the field to be taken to the hospital to get a CT scan, and they were diagnosed with a concussion. It wasn't necessary. So when you look at one CT scan being 300 to 400 chest x-rays to your head, and, you know, we say if you have more than one concussion that you're going to suffer, it's a potential to suffer permanent brain injury down the road. The NFL suit, the CTE, all these things going on. And we know that if you have one or more CT scans, the likelihood of getting cancer 10 years down the road increases. Mm-hmm. So these young kids that are playing, getting CT scans, I think if parents knew that, they wouldn't be as quick to ask for a CT scan to appease their peace of mind.
You can't go a day without getting some Google alert as to an article, you know, in USA Today or New York Times or, you know, all these major, you know, the Time Magazine cover of Time Magazine for September. It came out on my birthday, September 29th, and it had Chad Stover, who was a high school athlete that was playing football, and he died of a brain bleed. That was on the cover of Time Magazine. And tell me that's not having an impact on the game. You know, all we're here trying to do is make it safer. Nobody can, you know, we're not trying to represent that we can stop this from happening or you know, save somebody's life. But if nothing is done, what's going to happen to the game of football? It's going to change. I mean, it's already changing. But for this brain bleeding condition to have made the cover of Time Magazine this fall is a very serious impact.
And Dr. Ott, you had mentioned it could help the transport of the patient in a rural mm-hmm. area. There's one specific incident, player named Damon James in Western New York died, and he was taken to the closest hospital, and it took him 3 hours to get a CT scan. When it came out that it had a bleed, he then had to be transported to a Trauma One hospital in mm-hmm. Buffalo. He didn't get any care till over 5 hours, and he died. Right. So that's a major indication.
Major examples. And
we had 5 kids this year die, 3 of them in 1 week.
Of a brain bleed.
And then you look at Madison Square Garden, there was a heavyweight boxer who went 10 rounds. He was checked out by 4 ringside doctors. They all cleared him. They said, when you get back to Florida, have your doctor check you over. So the athletic state commissioned athletic trainer gave him a urine test, which is customary because they want to check for doping, and there was blood in the urine. So he said to his athletic trainer, grab a cab. This was in New York City at Madison Square Garden. Grab a cab to the nearest emergency room. He was in a coma by the time he got to the hospital, and they don't know if he's ever going to walk or talk again. I mean, all that brain function that could have been saved if they would have had more than just their subjective neurological evaluation could have helped.
In that instance, 4 ringside doctors, very well trained, experienced, 4 doctors missed it, giving their neurological evaluations. They missed it. And as a result, it was a catastrophic event. And we're not trying to say that it is going to, NFL is an example, very seldom is there a brain bleed. I mean, maybe a few times.
Right.
Or maybe perhaps there's more, but they're not detected, and not every brain bleed results in the need for neurosurgical intervention. Lots of times people have a brain bleed and it just simply dissipates. So, those that are known about in the NFL, not a lot. But the NFL is in a position. Roger Goodell wrote a letter to, in 2013 to, millions of fans and season ticket holders across the country, that it's, our responsibility in the NFL, because our actions influence actions of colleges and high schools. And, I could quote him, because the NFL stated that the NFL's commitment goes beyond the NFL, that their actions influence colleges, high schools, and youth football, stating it is a shared responsibility to protect the future of the game. So what we're looking for is, we want the NFL teams to use this technology, because then it makes it easier for colleges to accept it and for high schools, which is really where it's needed.
And maybe Jeremy might want to allude to this, but, in some schools, there's one athletic trainer, and we're lucky if we have that, and they're watching the whole team and have to be everywhere at once. And so one of the practical considerations is, and I think this would be good for everyone to hear, yeah, is that should every concussed or suspected, we have to remove them from play anyways in Texas. They don't go back in. It doesn't matter. But does everyone need to have their head sort of looked at and scanned with this device, or can it be for a certain cluster of symptoms and or presentation? Because a lot of times it's a quick assessment, Jeremy, correct me if I'm wrong, and you're going back to what you need to do, even though it's 1 or 2 minutes. Is there a way to break it down for some people where it may not be as practical to remove them from play, like in the NFL? I mean, that's the perfect scenario.
We have written protocols for use. Dr. Maroon wrote up a use protocol, that he follows, basically, and this is how he would use it, and those criteria and that sort of thing. But, in simply using it on every athlete suspected of a concussion doesn't mean you have to do it right at that minute. Mm-hmm. You can wait and do it after the game. I mean, they're not doing anything now, right? I mean, there's no objective test now. They're just simply given a neurological evaluation, deemed to be concussed, and they're out of the game. Well, we're simply saying that at that point, you could, depending on the severity of their symptoms, depending on the athletic trainer's neurological evaluation, will dictate when they do it. If they do it right at, within the next 10 minutes, or if they'd wait and do it after the game or the next day.
Well, that's good to know when the sensitivity is there, and it'd be helpful to know.
As you said, if Jeremy had an athlete who he had to take out that had a concussion and looked at him and went on because he's the only one there, I'm sure he's going to be looking at him again. Mm-hmm. I mean, you never stop your clinical evaluation. So he might not feel as though the infrascanner, he didn't have much concern right away. But as you say, a lot of times the deterioration can happen quickly. So maybe if Jeremy looked at him again in 20 minutes, he might think, I just want to make sure here.
And all your studies and all the, background stuff that you've done with the scanner, have you seen any false positives, or have you seen an example of where it might have missed it, You know, we're, I guess my big question, and probably everybody, is that we don't want to use this and say, well, this is a be-all, do-all, and then all of a sudden we miss something with it. I mean, I guess that's another concern.
Your question is a good question, and Dr. Volodka brought that question up to us when we were meeting with the Major League Baseball medical directors. And the question is, if you do a test with the infrascanner, are you going to stop your evaluation at that point? Because, oh, well, you know, he's not bleeding, so we don't need to continue to give him a neurological evaluation. And the answer is absolutely not. You would never stop your neurological evaluation. You continue to do what you've been trained to do. All you're doing is getting a little bit more objective data to help in making that decision. It's not the end all. It simply is another test that provides objective data. Now, will it miss the sensitivity? And the FDA studies would be 90% at 3.5 cc's in volume, which is a very, very small bleed. It wouldn't become surgically relevant until it was upwards to, what, 30, 40, 50 cc's in volume. And the sensitivity of the infrascanner, as the increase in, as the volume of blood would increase, so does the sensitivity up to 100%. So, you know, if there's a time goes by, it's an acute bleed is 72 hours. After 72 hours, it becomes different chemical mechanisms. Hemoglobin is no longer present at that point. That was one of the things that Dr. Collins, when he evaluated the technology in Pittsburgh at Impact, his initial response when we met with him was that we need to have one of these at every clinic, CIC clinic across the country. And then we got a little bit further into it and training him, and he realized that it's an acute bleed. It's within 72 hours. So he said, well, we don't even see patients at our clinic until a week, 10 days afterwards. So there may be chronic, conditions and these sorts of things. So that's why Impact put the technology as part of its concussion management model under step two, which is if a concussion is suspected, at the discretion of the trained medical personnel, either to send the patient for CT, MRI, or a near-infrared device such as an infrascanner. So it was included, it had enough respect to Impact to include it in the concussion management model, but not something that would be necessarily used at their clinic because of their time constraints.
All right, so on that, did you?
I was just a follow-up, and I kind of to the question, and in your studies, I guess I wasn't insinuating you stop your neuro eval. My question was more, is there a chance the infrascanner could miss the bleed that a CT would pick up?
Yes, and again, it all comes down to the athletic trainer or the physician's discretion in the symptoms. If somebody's symptoms are worsening, I don't care what the infrascanner test says, they're going to be sent off because they're entering now into criteria where they're going to get a CT scan. So you don't necessarily say, I'm not going to give them a CT scan because this test came out to be negative, but it's certainly one factor that you would consider amongst other factors. And that's a great question because that comes up all the time.
All right, so we wanted to talk about the process, and Olivia has volunteered. So Olivia, why don't you go stand right there next to Ms. McGowan, and she's actually going to scan Olivia's head right here. So if you're watching live,
what am I doing? I'm scanning her head.
Yeah, you can. So you can take your headphones off, and then Janine is going to talk through that process so that she can explain to listeners, viewers.
So the black cap is a fiber optic disposable shield. It turns the infrascanner on and off, and the two probes are what the near-infrared light travels through. So you take 8 data points on the head. You take the frontal, the temporal, parietal, and the occipital lobes. You start on the left, and you go to the right. And what the infrascanner is measuring is the difference in optical density between the left and the right-hand sides.
All right, so one of the reasons I selected Olivia is she's got a lot of hair. Mm-hmm. So one of the questions that we wanted to ask is that a problem? Because I see all these NFL players with these dreadlocks that are about 6 inches off their head, you know. And so Olivia's got a lot of hair, so they're going to go ahead and talk through that as they're doing it.
One thing we have to do because of the hair is there's a parting technique where you part the hair so that you see the scalp and you place the tips on the scalp.
All right, so while he's doing that there, she's sitting down. One of the questions I have is, Do they have to be sitting down? I know you did it on Dr. Ott before we got over here standing up, but what if this person has a...
Your camera's right there, so you might want to get to the side.
Yeah, Pete, you're blocking the camera there. Yeah, there you go. All right, so do they have to be sitting down? Because if you have somebody that is not doing real well, maybe they're feeling woozy because they got hit in the head and you want to check them with this, you don't want them standing up or sitting up. You want them to lay down.
No, that's fine. And when they're laying down for the occipital lobes, you can turn the infrascanner upside down. There are two measurement buttons on the back, and holding it upside down makes it easier to reach those occipital lobes. Firefighters and EMS go over that technique frequently when somebody's on a collar board.
So Janine, go ahead and tell us what's going on, why he's doing it.
Okay, so he got a red reading, which is probably because of her hair. So if you get a red reading, you go back, two or three more times to confirm. If you get all green, you know it's all green. You don't have to confirm that. But if you get a red, it could be because of user error. So that's what you want to confirm.
Very interesting. Good thing I picked Olivia.
You might want to take your glasses off.
All right, so... And you're telling me you just got some new tips that are longer.
Yes.
Do those tips make it, the longer tips make it easier to part the hair?
Well, they're a little bit longer. So a lot of times with dreadlocks or, different types of hair, the longer prongs make it easier to get to the scalp over that hair. Right now they are 19 millimeters and they elongated them to 23 millimeters.
All right, so the training video is on YouTube, but you go to med-logic.us, and it has those on there, right?
It's not the full training video. There's a second extended version where you go over step-by-step the, recharging cradle, all of the different points of the head. It's just more detailed.
I know I shouldn't be the bad guy, but what's the cost of this?
Well, we have a military price that we have to adhere by. Right now we're running a special for high schools. It's sort of a case by case. If we got a sale for multiple devices, we could negotiate with our manufacturer for a lesser cost. So it's sort of on a basis
that. Kind of a ballpark figure that, if athletic trainers or school districts wanted to buy these,
well,
if we're looking at kind of a ballpark.
The
what
top
kind of
price is $18,000. We work with several banks that do a leasing program. You can have an annual, quarterly, or monthly payment. Instead of being an $18,000 problem, it could be a $3,000 problem for 4 years, which, boosters are. And it can go into the entire school budget because it can be used on all of the kids, not just the athletes. That's how West Allegheny's athletic director, he's also an athletic trainer, and their district doctor wrote the use protocol is for the entire school district.
And before we started the podcast, I asked you all in the demonstration, there's 8 points. What about the space in between? And I thought you guys had a really good answer for that. Like, what if you miss the pocket of space? If you're only standardized to do those certain points, what if there is a space lesion present there? And I thought you had a good response. Can you repeat that for...
Yes,
for us now.
Actually, Dr. Joseph Wackerly, who's up in Kansas City, he suggested that you can rescan and change your positioning slightly so that you're getting more of an area on, say, the temporal or the frontal or the parietal, just by rescanning and slightly changing position.
All right, so
there's no measured difference in optical density between the left and the right side of each of the four sections of the brain that we tested.
So after the user error or the big hair error, so
that's more my technique and being a little nervous,
Yeah, you're working in kind of tight spaces, trying not to hit the mic, but.
But that's one thing about the training is that we go over all those things that oftentimes cause user error, so that you're cognizant of it, you practice, and then you can get really great at using it.
And Dr. Ott, I had answered your question earlier, which I thought was an excellent question because. The question was that the range of the test is only between the two fiber optics, and your section of your brain may be larger than that. And if you're measuring, is it possible that there's something in between? Because what happens is the near infrared light is sent, into your through the bone tissue, into a brain, and reflects back, and the test is whether there's a measured difference between that test. If there is a measured difference, it's because of the presence of hemoglobin, which is present in extravascular bleeding. And Dr. Ott's question was, well, you could have missed that, and the answer is yes. But because of the nature of your brain and the way that a blood clot in your brain is for subdural and epidural hematoma, which is exactly what this is testing for, is it very diffuse in the sense that even a small volume of blood is spread over a large area because it's in a very, very narrow, you know, space between your brain and your dura. So that, you know, the brain, if there are torn blood vessels, it'll fill up that area of blood, but it does it in a real diffuse manner so that actually it's even a small volume takes up a lot of space.
All right, so Olivia, talk about your end. You just had your brain scanned. They said there was one there. So how did you feel? Did it hurt? Was it annoying? Just tell me what you were thinking because you just had your head scanned.
It didn't hurt, but it was just like going all the way like in my head, I guess. It hurt, but not like a lot.
So it was uncomfortable?
Yeah,
somewhat. Because you're kind of being poked in the head?
Yeah.
All right, so just imagine if you were maybe feeling a little nauseous, a little dizzy. Do you think that you would have been able to stand that? Because I know you were leaning forward at some point because he was trying to get all your hair out of the way. So I know it's hard to say when you're not dizzy, but just if you were dizzy, nauseous, and you're leaning forward, having him press on your head, how do you think that's going to affect you?
I wouldn't want to do it.
You don't think you'd want to do it? All right,
well,
so
I think I had him do it to me a couple times before we started, too. I think that the answer to that question to me is you don't really feel anything. I mean, other than the two prongs, and they're not prongs, they're just the two tips touching your head. And, you know, if you're sensitive to that, then you may feel, but as far as the machine putting out any feeling, there is, I'm right about that. There is no sensation from that. It's more your discomfort from the concussion that you're probably having more so than it is the test itself. And it's just the discomfort of moving around the head with the machine and, you know, that type of a thing.
So and the benefit would outweigh the discomfort.
Right.
Like and knowing there's no ionizing radiation that they're getting, that's good.
I scanned a woman who was 89 years old and very sensitive. If you were when they were putting on the sleeve to take her blood pressure, she was wincing in pain and just was very uncomfortable for her. And I was able to scan her head, you know, multiple times while we were waiting for her to get a CT scan. And she didn't have any apparent pain. So.
All right. Go ahead.
your device is actually listed in the recommended care for concussion of the impact testing system. Can you talk about that?
I know you mentioned it briefly, but in one of the things you sent me, it was in there. So.
Well, impact is a neurocognitive test that gives a baseline for students at a certain age, you know, depending on the way the school deals with it. They're taking a test and they get establish a baseline. And then if there's a concussion, the student would then be given another baseline test to see where they fall, whether they're meeting their numbers or whether they're not. And often the doctors will not return that athlete to play until they've got their baseline, they're reaching their baseline numbers again. So it's an excellent tool for monitoring, you know, progression and Dr. Ott can speak to it so much more fluently than me. But the point is that impact is standard. It's used all over the country, all over the world. It's the most widely used neurocognitive test. So we think that impact sets a standard. And we like to think that it has recognized the technology and included that as part of its concussion management model, opens it up to be part of a standard of care. That's very helpful when we're talking to people about using it. They're familiar with impact and they say, oh, really, you know, it's part of impact's concussion management model. That's a good thing. So we were very happy about that.
But of course, if other schools were utilizing a different cognitive tool, it doesn't necessarily have to be utilized in conjunction with impact.
Absolutely.
Or that protocol, but it could be utilized even if people didn't have a cognitive testing component.
That's correct. Absolutely.
So real quick, is the impact test, in your opinion, like is it's definitely the number one? Is there anything else that is used as much? or close to it?
You know, certainly in the past year or so, C3 Logic has emerged as another cognitive testing tool, but it also has a component of balance, some more ocular motor type tasks involved. But I still think, I mean, we've been approached, as you can imagine, numerous times by different vendors, and perhaps I'm biased because I train with the guys that developed the instrument, but it's also something that our the city of Houston and Memorial Hermann in general have just invested so much expertise and money in to get all of our athletic trainers trained, to be able to utilize the test in our school settings, to do post-injury care. So it's hard to deviate sometimes, too, from something that we've spent so much time in. And it does have the most research to back it. And we've participated in that research. So, again, it's hard for me to want to look at something that isn't scientifically validated to the point that impact is now. Now, it's not saying that some of these other instruments won't move towards that, but now it's still really what we want to utilize in our clinics.
And Jeremy, that it just the topic brings up I believe that the trend in sports medicine is to try to get as much objective data as possible. I think that, you know, impact is certainly fills a niche of getting objective data, and I think that there are balance tests that you can do on sidelines that are objective data, you know, instead of just looking at somebody and deciding whether they've got good balance or not. And I think that there are concussion tools that the NFL has given grants to, that tools to identify whether somebody is concussed. I know Neurokinetics is one of those companies. It's from Pittsburgh. They've got goggles and they're measuring eye movement and these sorts of things. And I think that, you know, our device is simply in that chain of care. You know, once they've been suspected of a concussion and you've got objective, you know, criteria, you know, these sorts of things, you just have one more test that's giving you objective data. I think that's the trend, is to have as many objective tools as possible to eliminate that possibility of a subjective error.
Yeah, so I think Brad mentioned this earlier, and one of the big questions is, you know, here in Pasadena, we have five schools. There's five high schools. Almost all of our varsity football games are played at the stadium. Almost all of our varsity soccer games are played at the stadium. I don't know of any other sport where they would really, I mean, baseball, I guess, most of those are played, again, at the stadium, which is right across the street. So for our school district, is it going to be better for our school district to invest that much money, keep that one centrally located? Or, I mean, ideally, you guys want to have one in every school, and then we all know how to use it and things like that. But realistically, for a school district like ours, do you see that there? Or is it, like they should have mentioned earlier, Bentaub, since it's a trauma hospital, you know, and then EMS, is that going to be the best place for this tool?
I think it's good for all of these different uses. And we've had a lot of people say to us, and we sort of believe that the infrascanner is going to take the same form as the AED or the defibrillator, that they're going to be all over the place. I think that it's great for the athletic trainers to have on the sideline because they're the first in care. I think it would be great for Dr. Ott to have at her clinic because she sees patients that are still in the acute stage of a concussion, not only for the objective data it could give, but for the peace of mind for a parent, knowing that it's more than just a subjective review. And I think, you know, with the firefighters and the EMS being on the vehicles, it's a wonderful use for it, the military in their rural settings. So I think that it has a lot of, I don't think there's one particularly best place for the infrascanner.
Did you have any other thoughts on that, Dr.?
No, I think that was well said.
All right. I think that's all the questions that I had written down. What do you guys have any other thoughts, questions, concerns?
I guess the only thing, I mean, and it's not really a question, it's just kind of my perspective on it. I think this is it's an excellent device. There's no question about it. I think that, you know, I've come from the NFL. The NFL is a little different animal than it is at the high schools and junior highs in Texas or any other high school. You know, I think that as this rolls out, I think our biggest thing is probably going to be trying to figure out where the best place to put this. Because I think, you know, reality of it is not every school is going to be able to buy one. I mean, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
You know, maybe every NFL team will, but that's not, you know, reality of it is. So I think that, you know, if we look at a device like this, it is important to see where is the best place to have it located and where is it going to benefit, you know, these schools and these athletic trainers and so on the best? And is that with your emergency rooms? Is that where, you know, if you take a kid in and you say, hey, listen, like a Memorial Hermann, if we have these in our hospital settings or emergency room settings and say, hey, let's take you to this injury clinic or this here, we'll check you there, and then we can maybe use it in a setting like that. Mm-hmm. I just think that we're going to find that, you know, as this rolls out, you talk about AEDs. Well, it took a while for everybody mm-hmm. to be able to get AEDs too. I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's a slow process, and you know, I think it's just the reality of it is it's as good as it is, it's still not something that everybody's going to be able to handle. So our challenge is probably to see where the best place for it in our environment and to benefit the most people.
When I introduced myself, I indicated that my former practice merged into what I do now. And I also said that there were challenges in what we're trying to do in terms of disruptive technology being introduced at these levels, NFL, high schools, colleges, hospitals, everything else. And your points are well taken, and that's what we, Janine and I, and the people that we work with every day are trying to solve this problem. Every day we're trying to figure out how to make this work so that it provides the most benefit to where it's really needed. And obviously price is an issue, and you know, we work on that. We work on leasing programs, we work, you know, on different ways to get it to schools and colleges so that it can be in the place where it's most valuable. But again, you know, you're identifying exactly what we do every day to try to figure out how to solve that problem.
And I don't think that it's a black and white answer. If Jeremy were to have an InfraScanner and be able to use it on the athletes here, since he is the first person looking and caring for these kids, again, he knows what to do with them. Do they need to get to an emergency room? Do they need to get to a hospital that has neuro, you know, surgical opportunities there? In the ER, you have a lot of patients where a child might have fallen off a table or something. It has nothing to do with athletics, and the parent goes in and wants a CT scan. Well, the parent doesn't know all the radiation that child will be getting and how detrimental it is to their long-term health. So there, the ER physician, and we've been told this by many ER physicians, they could give an InfraScanner to appease that parent to say, you know, we've done something more than just the subjective evaluation. This is some objective information and everything's okay, but keep an eye on your child. You know, if something changes, bring them back. But I just think that, I just don't think that it's a black and white answer. I think that in every setting, there's a different use for it that is very valuable.
I think if our athletic trainers did have the opportunity to utilize this, you know, we've talked about the credentials of people that can utilize this instrument, but there's going to have to be a lot of education in addition to the parents and the coaches, because some scenarios that will creep up and be on CNN are the coach that runs and sees Jeremy utilizing the InfraScanner on an athlete's head and pestering him about what the findings are and if they're fine, interpreting that as a means. And we know that CTs and MRIs are almost always negative with concussion. However, we still have a misconception that you don't have a concussion that still exists today, even with awareness that there isn't something significant going on. So much like the accelerometer started out in helmets several years ago, where we literally had examples of parents chasing the athletic trainer down the sidelines to inquire as to what G-force a child was hit with, there will have to be some very good education going on with people around that it is the tool and everything you just said here, because there can be some ways to approach it that cannot be utilized correctly.
I think that that's what you just stated is so important for the future of contact sports anyways. I mean, you know, you read the Time Magazine article about Chad Stover. His teammates said, well, you know, he just wasn't himself. He didn't act the same when he came back out at halftime. He wasn't himself. He wasn't acting right. Well, you know what? Those players should speak up and tell the athletic trainers, you know, Bob's not right. He's acting differently. You should give him a real thorough evaluation. Those are the cultural changes that need to take place in parents. I mean, we have parents' stories from some of these doctors that we're working with where the parents go and find another doctor to clear their player because that doctor's son plays football too, and they're competing for the same position. And, you know, there's fights. Parents fight like mad to get their kids back in the game after they've been concussed. And it's unbelievable. They have no idea what they're doing.
Yep. So I think Dr. I said it briefly, but what about schools that don't have an athletic trainer? I know you said the nurse would be capable of using it, but at our school, a nurse certainly isn't qualified. If there's any athletic injury, they're supposed to send them to us. They're not the ones that should be dealing with concussion stuff at all. And they're certainly not on the sidelines. I mean, usually our nurses leave at 2:30 when school ends. So, you know, those schools that don't have athletic trainers, and you said you don't want it in the coaches' hands because they're not responsible to the physicians. How can you see this tool being used in those situations? Because we have a lot of schools here, even in Texas, and you guys said in Pennsylvania, there's not even like student athletic trainers in the high schools and things like that. So,
well, I would look at EMS as a potential alternative for that. It's not an easy problem to solve, but you know, there, I think it probably is a law that you have to have at least an EMS vehicle at one of these games. I don't know.
That always happens.
Yeah, I don't. In some states it is. I know. In some states it's the law. You have to have emergency medical services for
especially
these
club teams. And right. I mean, we're a huge club
practice
team.
You're missing practice. All these other. I mean, it's a challenge. It's a problem. And again, it's a very difficult situation.
And as when we were talking about the nurses. As I mentioned before, West Allegheny wrote a protocol for the entire school, for all the kids, not just the athletes. Mm-hmm. So the five school nurses were trained in case a child fell in gym class or somebody fell on the playground or a teacher slipped on the ice walking in to work. That's why the nurses were trained, so that they could sort of do that while on duty during school hours. If a non-athlete gets hurt, they're ready to use the infrascanner if the need arises.
All right. You guys, I know on your website it has a grant program. We talked about, you know, the maximum price is like $18,000, which is, that's pretty high. But you said they did fundraising at one of the schools and they have a grant program. Why don't you talk about that?
Well, that, first of all, pricing is a sensitive subject. And just because we have articulated a price that was used for military purposes,
right.
We are structuring the pricing differently for high schools. And it's less than that. And it can be considerably less than that if more than one school buy. You know what I mean? If we're doing, you know, several, we can really work on the price because, you know, it's again part of what we're trying to do. But with that said, what was the question?
About the grant program?
Oh, applying for grants?
Yeah, well, it says it on your website, like a grant or fundraise for it,
well,
right?
Well, West Allegheny applied for a grant at Highmark and got it.
And there's
$10,000.
A crowd fundraising program that we have with a company out of New York City called Reaching Our Goals. Last year, I think they raised $56 million for different club sports and colleges and high schools, which is, it's a really, you don't have to go door to door and sell anything or do any car washes. It takes about 10 minutes of time from every athlete. And they give 10 email addresses to, you know, their favorite fans, the people that love them and care about their safety. And they will send out solicitations to get a donation to put towards the infrascanner. And as I mentioned before, we work with several banks that have leasing programs with a dollar buyout that makes the payment much easier.
And we're working in West Virginia with a lot of oil and gas. As obviously we're in Houston, but in Western Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia with Marcellus Shale oil and gas drilling. And so we're trying to work with some of the larger companies to be able to, you know, provide funding for school districts in West Virginia as an example. So we're looking for, you know, the community to get involved and organizations within communities to get involved. And a lot of that we leave up to the school districts because they know who their funding partners are. You know, we've talked to school districts and they say, you know, we've got people that we can go to that we need to work and work this in a little bit. But those are other, you know, ways to overcome this challenge.
So you're talking about, the oil and gas. Do any of those industries have this device? Because I know we talked about the military and we talked about sports. Is there any other industry besides hospital?
Not yet.
No?
Not yet.
Because, I mean, you know, people falling off of the towers or obviously the explosions, those kind of things. But mm-hmm. I guess they could just get sent to the ER.
Again, we think that's a great market for it, but it's not been broken in there yet.
Prisons, we think, is an interesting market.
Any of you guys want to sign up to go talk to the prisons? Anybody? Olivia? personal experience, you've had your head scanned. I wasn't talking about being in jail. Sorry. I said that the wrong way. So the grant program, how many people have you guys had through the crowdfunding grant receive one, or that you know of specifically?
One school is working on it. They just started, but that's a lot of the schools don't want to do the fundraising. Yeah. So it's an opportunity. It's a program created. And I think that as the education grows and the awareness grows, that it's going to be more utilized.
And you guys said 2012 was when y'all started?
Well, it was FDA approved in January of 2013. We started in 2012 just in terms of awareness and trying to, you know, get some people interested in it, doctors using it, that sort of thing.
Did you say one or two high schools were already committed? Or maybe, I don't even know if we asked you the question.
This is important because as with the NFL and colleges and high schools, we really didn't start marketing the product in sports medicine until after the Pittsburgh Steelers athletic trainers did their evaluation. It was just sort of an internal decision that we made. We weren't going to start calling, you know, other teams. We weren't going to start reaching out to a lot of places. We made a lot of places aware of this, but we didn't really try to sell it because we wanted to have the Pittsburgh Steelers athletic trainers, John Norwig and Sonia Gaslin, we wanted their evaluation. And when we got their evaluation, it was in August. And August was too late because everybody's already into doing what they're doing, and they're not going to change, and they're not going to, you know, even take minutes to talk to you. It's just very difficult. Now is really our time because, you know, nobody had it for their budgets, school districts, nobody had it. It just was a very difficult. We were mostly this fall just making people aware of it and putting out that, put it in for your budget for next year. And, you know, going to the NFL Combine and doing, you know, going with now some athletic trainers that have been using it. Miami Dolphins had it this season as well. So, you know, having some people getting a little bit of use into it. Really, this is our season to sell coming up. Because it's off season, people are more open-minded to taking time, you know, to look at it. We couldn't get Jeff Kaplan's attention until now. So, I mean, this is really the time. So I don't want to look back and say what, you know, we were able to sell to some school districts and we weren't to others. Really, this is the season because they now can put it in their budgets for next year and they can plan a little bit more ahead.
I don't want to get hung up on the price. Again, I know you guys said...
Neither do I.
But one of the things is, do you guys have experience with working with high school budgets? Because I know our coaches have tried to buy a large amount of equipment for the weight room, you know, that was over the allotted budget, and they couldn't split that into 2 years. And you're talking about the bank lease program. Here, at least here, I know that I can't carry over money. So I don't think I would be allowed to say, okay, well, I'm going to pay the bank this much each year because I wouldn't have the invoice for this, that this product has been received and paid in full. I'm not an expert in budgeting, but I'm pretty sure that's how it would work here. Have you guys addressed that at all?
Is that the same with the school budget, or is that just the athletic budget?
Yeah, the whole school district would work the same.
Yeah, we haven't heard that. And to answer your question, Dr. Ott, two high schools in Pittsburgh have it and are using it. But we haven't run across that in Pennsylvania. So again, I think it's different state by state.
And it may be different district by district.
Correct.
But I just knowing here, you know, this is my experience, and I was just wondering if you guys had experience with that at all.
The challenge is how to purchase something that's not within the budget.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that you have to go to booster organizations, you have to go to outside organizations, you have to go to community organizations. I think those are some of the challenges that we, you know, are trying to, you know, manage.
Okay. All right. So the kids are about to take off. You guys have any other thoughts or comments there?
I think it's a great device. I think the hardest part is just being able to get it in the hands of the people that need it. You know, and I think that it's, I guess, dealing with concussions is as often as I've kind of seen the revolution of this whole thing. And, you know, I think it's driven by a lot of media attention, and it can be a very alarming thing.
Any questions?
So I think this just gives everybody another tool to look at. It's not the be-all. You know, I think the most important thing is people can't lose track of their evaluation and
right.
the whole process. This is and to me, this is just another tool to put in that kit of you still are going to do all your tests and you're still going to do all the other things. This is just kind of an alarm if you do this test and all of a sudden you see something that we're not used to seeing. It says, okay, we need to, this needs to move on. This is beyond my expertise. And right. I think that's probably the part of it that I think is important. It's going to take a while to get that into all these hands that, you know, you want to do. Mm-hmm. And you can start at the high levels and work down. It's just, that's always going to be an issue that you're going to have to kind of overcome. And I think as time goes by and you see that, you know, more and more people are getting it, and then it's going to be, you know, we're going to get the data on it and see how many you actually do. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, for every 10,000 we did, you know, what was the result of that? I mean, it, as you get it into hands of people. So I think that's interesting. But, going back to concussion stuff, I think being in it, and I think it's just so important that people don't take one tool and say this is the tool. This is just something that, you know, it's a great adjunct to what's in the system. And, yeah. And concussions are obviously a major, major issue in the sports world today. And driven by the media, so I think it's whatever we can do to help that, it's just finding the ways to do it.
We agree wholeheartedly, and I don't think any of the different tests that you use are the be-all end-all. I mean, it's all, mm-hmm. you know, your medical professionals, your evaluation, your judgment, and all these tools, as you said, in your toolbox that help you to make a better judgment call for these kids.
Jeremy, we send them to Dr. Hyatt, and that's the be-all, end-all.
Yep, I
there's my plug.
Jeremy, now you know why we came from Pittsburgh to participate, because in order for us to be better at what we do, we need to have this kind of interaction. Mm-hmm. And this is what's very helpful in order for us to, you know, evaluate and reevaluate and try to solve this problem. It's, you know, not just talking to people in Pittsburgh, but talking to people in Houston and all over the country. And that's what we're doing. So
we're not big hockey people down here, but I would think hockey would also have a high incidence of, you know, concussions and that kind of thing. Are you guys in with any of the hockey teams?
Not yet.
Not yet.
Another great market, but not yet.
We just haven't focused on it. I mean, we've made the point that we're trying to do this in sort of a controlled manner, mm-hmm. in a rollout in a certain way, and we really were focused a lot on football and boxing and some other things like that. Hockey's around the corner. We're going to be, I'm sure, working with some of the teams.
You know, some school districts would probably ask, and they do this with Impact, is what athletes do we focus on, not to discriminate, but we have to look at our budget and what do we do? And it seems, you know, concussions, obviously the risk is higher in our collision sports, but mm-hmm. the risk of, you know, intracranial bleeding is actually higher in sports that don't have helmets. Right. And, you know, where things aren't controlled as much. So, you know, in some ways, people may laugh at when I say this, but you may even consider starting in sports that don't necessarily have helmets, you know, as one starting point. Many might disagree with me on that, but that's really when we've seen people with bleeds. I can't think of hardly any situations where we've had, you know, and I've been doing this for quite a while now, where there's been a bleed or we've had that catastrophic situation happen where there indeed has been a bleed in a contact helmeted sport.
Dr. Maroon is classic for saying exactly what you just said, that he's been, you know, seeing patients for, you know, many, many years, and it's a very rarity that there's a brain bleed. But he said there are a lot of these athletes that are getting CT scans, and that's sort of what he's focused on, is trying to reduce that number.
So that might be a better method than in that
yeah.
situation. Understood.
I gotcha. Final questions, Jasmine, Coy? Yeah. See, we should have put Coy. She's a lot prettier than me, so that she could have just sat here and I could have just talked.
And for you all that we keep referring to Coy is an athletic trainer in the sports medicine concussion program with the Ironman, who has a background in high school sports, but I've been really fortunate to have her work with us. And so she does a lot of the clinical evals, and we get to see people. I mean, her expertise from the sideline all into the way that the person comes in the clinic, I mean, that's very valuable.
Mm-hmm. We're amazed at the Texas with high schools having, you know, what is it, the classes for athletic trainers at the high school level, which is amazing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They don't have that in Pennsylvania, not that we're aware of.
And I guess a little plug for U of H, we have an athletic training program, master's program at University of Houston, which we're all very affiliated with. So there's no shortage of good training for athletic trainers in Texas.
That's and for sure.
And I think we can plug, we just had a weekend last weekend, and this is kind of tells you the emphasis of athletic training. GHATS, which is Greater Houston Athletic Trainers Society, just had a student trainer workshop last Saturday. 1,200 students?
There was about 1,100 student athletic trainers there. Hmm. And then, you know,
that's from the Greater Houston area. So it's very important here. And I think that you commend all the high school athletic trainers for getting their students involved and doing a lot of those kinds of things. It's a it's certainly a very, very upcoming. I think it's a very, being in the position I'm in now, I think we're seeing more and more. I think the best part of athletic training today is that schools and administrations are really understand the importance of athletic trainers now. And we're seeing them now with wanting to get coverage, not just in your high schools, but all the way down into your middle schools and all your athletic events. So, we're lucky in Texas that's the approach and the mentality of and the importance that they put on it.
All right. Well, pretty much wraps it up. As Brad mentioned, GHAT sponsors the CEU event. So if you logged in and watched it live, then you can get CEUs for, you know, sitting and watching us talk while you eat lunch. So it's a pretty cool opportunity. So if you guys are back home talking with athletic trainers, you may mention that, hey, you know, we talked on this. And if you watch live every Wednesday, then you can do that. So, you know, helps us out, helps you out, whatever. Our website, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. It'll have the links to the show notes. It'll have MedLogic's information. I have in the show notes all the information that they provided me. There was about 6 different articles talking about the InfraScanner. Obviously, there's the video that's going to be live on YouTube probably at the end of the day. So you can see our conversation. You can hear it. You can watch Pete scan Olivia's brain and she has a bleed or something like that. No, her hair got in the way. But anyway, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com will have links to all that stuff. And I'm on Twitter. Jasmine's been tweeting out stuff for me. She is a college student at A&M. She's coming back. She's doing everything she can to learn about athletic training because she plans to go to the Masters of Athletic Training at U of H. Nice. So it's good for her to interact with everybody here. So Jasmine, thanks for being here. Dr. Ott, thanks for taking time and for being third time. Brad, this is your third time as well. So thanks for being here. Janine, Pete, thanks for coming all the way down to the cold Texas weather to be on the Sports Medicine Broadcast.
Thank you so much for inviting us. Thank you so much for having us.
All right, so that's a wrap.